This is a reading of a cycle of lectures by Rudolf Steiner entitled Life Between Death and Rebirth. This is Lecture 2. As already stated, our studies this winter in this group are to be devoted to the consideration of the life between death and rebirth. It is in the nature of the case that all the explanations now to be given will only be fully understood when we come to the end of these lectures. We must presuppose the result of investigations made during the last few months. That which may serve to make these things fully understood can only appear gradually in the course of our studies. But in order to understand these important matters from the start, we shall begin with a brief study of man, such as any one of you may easily make in life. If we consider human life, the most prominent and important fact to an impartial observer will be the human ego itself. Now, we must distinguish between the true human ego and the consciousness of this human ego. For it is obvious that this human ego is certainly already active when man enters into existence at birth, and particularly during those years in which the child has no consciousness of capital I, during the years which are characterized by the circumstance that the child speaks of itself as of another person. We know that approximately about the third year of its life, of course there are children in whom this appears earlier, the child begins to be conscious of itself. It begins to speak of itself in the first person. And we know that this year is the extreme limit, although with some it extends further, of how far back the human being at a later period can remember what his soul has experienced. Thus in the life of a human being there is a distinct boundary, before which it is impossible for him to experience himself distinctly in his ego. Afterward he can experience himself in his ego. He is at home, as it were, in his ego, so that he can call forth from memory the experiences of this ego again and again. Can an impartial observation of life teach us why the child gradually passes from the state of being conscious of I to the consciousness of... Can an impartial observation of life teach us why the child gradually passes from the state of being unconscious of I to the consciousness of I? It can teach us the following. If from the earliest period after birth the child were never to come into any sort of collision with the outer world, it would never be able to come to a consciousness of its ego. You may yourselves observe very often how you notice your ego later in life. You need only knock yourself severely on the corner of a cupboard, and you will become aware of your ego through this knock. This collision with the outer world tells you that you are an ego, and you will hardly forget to think of your ego if you have given yourself a good bruise. These contacts with the outer world need not always be in the form of bruises for the child, but they are always there in certain varieties. If the child stretches forth its hands and touches something in the outer world, that is a gentle collision with the outer world. If the child opens its eyes and the light falls upon them, that also is a gentle collision with the outer world. By means of the outer world, the child comes to know itself, and the whole of its life during those early years really consists in learning to distinguish itself from the outer world, and by this means learning to know itself. And the result of a sufficient number of collisions with the outer world is the consciousness of self within its own soul. When the child has experienced a sufficient number of these contacts with the outer world, the result is that it calls itself I. When the child has progressed so far that it has gained consciousness of the ego, it becomes necessary to preserve this consciousness throughout the whole of life and to keep it active. But it cannot be maintained and kept active except by collisions taking place. These collisions with the outer world have fulfilled their object to a certain extent when the child has arrived at where it says I to itself. Nothing more can be learned from them toward the development of the I consciousness. From an impartial observation of the moment of waking, we can perceive that the I consciousness can only be maintained through collisions. We know that this I consciousness, with all its contents, together with those of the astral body, disappears during sleep, and that it reappears in the morning on waking. Why does it reappear then? Because the spiritual soul nature of man returns to the physical and etheric bodies. It then has collision or contact with the physical body and the etheric body. One who is able to observe minutely the psychic life of man, even without occult knowledge, can notice the following. When he wakens in the morning, he will find that many things preserved in his memory reappear in his consciousness. Ideas, feelings, and other things he has experienced emerge from the depths of his consciousness. If all this is minutely examined, even without occult knowledge, one finds that what appears has, to a certain extent, an impersonal character. It may even be observed that this character becomes more impersonal the further the events lie behind us, that is, the less we still participate in them with our direct eye consciousness. You may remember things very far back in your life, things which you bring to mind in such a way that you have as little share in these events as you have in something which you experience in the outer world and which does not particularly concern you. All that is preserved in our memory has the continual tendency to liberate itself from our I or ego. The fact that in spite of this, we observe that our ego again enters into our consciousness clearly each morning depends upon our entering each morning into the same body. This awakens our I consciousness anew each morning through the collision into which we come with it. While the child meets with outward collisions and thereby comes to the consciousness of the I, we keep this I consciousness active by coming in contact with our own inner being. And we not only knock against it in the morning, but we press into it and remain squeezed into our own body throughout the whole of our waking condition during the day. And consciousness of our ego is kindled by the counter-pressure of our body. Our eye is in our physical, etheric, and astral bodies, and continually comes into collision with them. Thus we may say that we owe ego consciousness to the circumstance that we are inwardly pressed into our body and perceive the counter-pressure from it. We collide with our body. This has the result that knocks always have. If you knock against something, an injury is caused, even although you may not at once notice it. Through the collisions between the ego and the body, injuries are continually being caused. Tiny destructive processes are produced in our body. We are continually destroying it. The whole of our I consciousness could not develop if we were not to collide with our body and thereby destroy it. And the sum total of these destructions is in truth none other than that which produces death in the physical world. We owe the preservation of our I consciousness to our own destructive activity, or to the circumstance that we are in the position continually to destroy our organism. In this way, we are the destroyers of our astral body, our etheric body, and our physical body. Our relation to the astral, etheric, and physical bodies is different from what it is to the ego itself. Ordinary life teaches us that we act destructively upon our ego. We shall now explain how we do this. Our ego is something, no matter for the present what it is, and inasmuch as it is something in the world, it has a certain value. A human being feels that his ego has this certain value in the great household of the world, but he can lessen this value. How do we diminish the value of our ego? If, for example, we hurt someone whom we perhaps ought to love, at that moment we have actually diminished the value of our ego. We are of less value in our ego after we have done someone an undeserved injury. That is a fact which each one may see for himself. You may also perceive that as a man never fulfills the ideal of his worth, the ego is really continually occupied in life with making itself of less and less value. That is to say, it is working to a certain extent at its own depreciation or destruction. As long as we remain in our ego, we still have power, during life, to avoid this destruction, although we do not always do so. Before we have passed through the portal of death, we can always do so. If we have done someone an undeserved injury, we can always make this good again during life in one way or another. If you reflect upon it, you will arrive at the conclusion that between birth and death it is possible for a person to influence his ego, to work at its depreciation, or to make it good again, or to make good again this destructive work. In the present cycle of human evolution, it is not possible for a human being in an ordinary way to do this with respect to his astral, etheric, and physical bodies, for he cannot work upon these with the conscious activity with which he works upon the ego, as he is not conscious in these parts of his being. The destruction he is continually bringing about in his astral, etheric, and physical bodies remains in them. He is destroying these continually, and is not in a position to do anything toward their repair. You may easily understand that if we were to enter on a fresh incarnation with the forces of our physical, etheric, and astral bodies, similar to those exercised by them at the close of our previous incarnation, they would be quite useless. The content of the soul is always the origin and body of force for that which is expressed in the body. The fact that at the close of life we have a feeble organism proves that our soul has not the forces to keep the body vigorous. In order to maintain our consciousness and keep it active, we have been continually destroying our bodies. In our next incarnation, we could do nothing with the forces possessed by us at the end of this life. Forces must again approach us, capable of so working in our next incarnation upon our astral, etheric, and physical bodies, that these, within certain limits, may be vigorous and healthy and useful for our new incarnation. It is possible for a human being to destroy his three bodies during earthly life. This may be observed even externally. But it is not possible for him, of himself, fully and in a healthy way, to work upon, organize, and restore them. Now, occult investigation shows that in the life between death and rebirth, forces come to us from beyond the earth, from conditions then experienced which restore the worn-out human coverings. Between death and rebirth, we live in the universe, in the cosmos, and the forces we cannot obtain from the earthly sphere, we have to draw from the other planets, which belong to the earth. In them are contained the reservoirs of force for our human vehicles. On the earth it is only possible for man to obtain the forces which continually restore the ego. The other principles of human nature have to draw their forces from worlds other than the earth. When we observe the astral body, we find that after death man expands, literally lives outward, for he grows larger and larger, so to say. He expands into all the planetary spheres. Through the expansion of his soul and spirit nature during the period in Kamaloka, man grows so large, various beings permeate one another in the process, that he reaches the boundary formed by the circle described by the moon round the earth. He then extends to the sphere of Mercury, then to the sphere of Venus. The Mercury and Venus, as they are referred to in occultism, then further to the spheres of Mars, Jupiter, and Saturn. He expands further and further. With the nature he carries through the portal of death, he lives in such a way that he becomes in the true sense a citizen of Mercury, Venus, Mars, etc., and he must be able in a certain way to make himself at home in these other planetary worlds. How does he come to feel at home there, or otherwise? To begin with, when his Kamaloka period is over, he must have within him something which enables him to form a relationship with the forces in the Mercury sphere, into which he is then transposed. Now, when the life of human beings, between death and rebirth, is investigated, it is found that this life is different with different human beings. It differs according as a person grows into the Mercury sphere with the consequences of a moral life, that is, with a moral frame of mind, or with the results of an immoral life. Of course, there are all possible shades. A person who takes with him the results of a moral disposition is in the Mercury sphere what we might call a spiritually sociable being. He is able to come in touch with other beings, either human beings who have died before him or beings belonging to the Mercury sphere, and live sociably with them, as it were. An immoral person becomes a hermit. He feels himself excluded from the company of the other inhabitants of this sphere. This is what a moral or immoral disposition brings with it in the life between death and rebirth. It is essential that we should understand that morality connects us with the beings living in this sphere, and that an immoral disposition shuts up our own being as if in a prison, so that we know that other beings are there, but we are as if in a shell and cannot get to them. This isolation of oneself is the result of an unsocial, immoral, human earthly life. With respect to the next sphere, which for the present we shall call the Venus sphere, according to occultism it is always so named, the religious frame of mind is what decides the way in which a man comes in touch with others. Those who, during their life on earth, acquired the feeling that everything transitory in man and in outer things is connected with something that endures, who feel that during life the mind should incline toward what is spiritual and divine, such people come in touch with the beings of this sphere. On the other hand, those who are materialistically inclined, who cannot turn their minds to what is eternal, imperishable, and divine, condemn themselves in this sphere to solitary imprisonment, as it were, in their own being. Through occult investigation, we can see, particularly in the case of this sphere, how we prepare in our astral body, by the way we live here on earth, the conditions under which we live there. In a certain way, we have to develop here on earth the understanding of and inclination toward what we wish to come in touch with there. Consider for a moment how mankind on the earth has been kept in touch with divine spiritual life by means of the various religions and philosophies throughout the ages, in the manner appropriate to each. Human evolution could only progress in an orderly manner through the various religions having been given by those whose work was demanded by the times. These drew their teaching from the one source, the source of religious life, at various times for various peoples, according to the disposition of each, and according to climate and other conditions. These religions sprang from one common source, but they were graduated according to the conditions of the various peoples, and even at the present time, people are gathered into groups on the earth according to their religion and their conception of the world. Through that which our religion, our conception of the world, produces in our soul, we prepare ourselves to understand and unite with the Venus sphere. The religious feelings of a Hindu, a Chinaman, a Muslim, or a Christian so prepare his soul that in the Venus sphere it understands and has sympathy for those who have the same feelings and who have developed their souls with the aid of the same religious teachings. We may say that when investigated occultly, it can be clearly seen that whereas on the earth mankind is still divided into races, nations, etc., and human beings are distinguished in this way, although in the future this will be changed, and it is even now beginning to be changed, in the Venus sphere which we live through with human and other beings, there is no such division into races. People are there distinguished solely according to their religion, their conception of the world. A certain division still exists, because while on earth religious ideas depend to a certain extent on conditions of race and nationality. There the racial element is not the criterion, but what the soul has experienced through having had a particular religion. We always spend a certain length of time in this sphere after death. Then we expand and pass on to the next sphere, which is the sun sphere. Between death and rebirth, we as souls actually become dwellers on the sun. Something more is necessary for this sun sphere than for the Venus sphere. If we wish to thrive in the sun sphere between death and rebirth, it is a prime necessity for us to understand not merely one group of human beings, but all human beings. We have to be able to make connecting links with all souls. In the sun sphere, we feel like hermits if we are divided by the prejudices of a certain religion and are unable to understand those who have followed some other religion. One who on earth was only able to see the excellence of one religion does not in the sun sphere understand those who have followed other religions. But this lack of understanding is not the same as it is on the earth. Here people may walk side by side without understanding each other deeply. Their religious views may differ. In the sun sphere, as we all expand to that and interpenetrate one another, we are together, and yet are separated by our inner being. But this separation and lack of understanding are there the source of frightful suffering. When we meet anyone of a different faith, we feel a reproach which weighs upon us continually and cannot be alleviated, because on earth we did not fit ourselves for this. What we are now saying will be better understood if, starting from this life between death and rebirth, we refer to initiation. For what the initiate experiences when he enters the spiritual worlds is somewhat similar to life between death and rebirth. The initiate has to live into the same spheres, and if he were to live in the prejudices of a one-sided view of life, he would experience the same torments as are experienced in this sun sphere. Therefore, it is necessary that initiation should be preceded by a complete understanding of all the religions on the earth, an understanding of what is in each single human soul, no matter what religion it belongs. Otherwise, all that we do not understand comes toward us laden with torment, like immensely high mountains threatening to fall upon us, or like explosions launched at us, so that we feel all the force of the explosion burst upon us. All lack of understanding which we bring to another, because we have shut ourselves up, acts in this manner in the spiritual worlds. This has not always been the case. In pre-Christian times, the evolution of humanity was not such that people had to acquire this understanding of each single human soul. Humanity had first to pass through one-sidedness, but those who were led up to a certain stage of leadership in the world had always to acquire, more or less consciously, that which can give understanding for all, without any distinction. Even if a certain human being was only the leader of one nation, he had to be led in a certain way to understand each single human soul. This is indicated in a wonderful manner in the Old Testament, where Abraham meets Melchizedek, the priest of the Most High. He who understands this passage knows that at this moment Abraham, who was destined to be the leader of his people, was initiated with respect to the understanding of the divine, which can come into every human soul, although not in full consciousness, as was the case in later initiations. In the passage where the meeting of Abraham with Melchizedek is described, a deep mystery in the evolution of humanity is concealed. humanity had gradually to be prepared to pass through the sun's sphere, and really to bring the fruit thereof with it. How did this come to pass? The first impulse in earthly evolution for the proper passage through the sun's sphere was given by the mystery of Golgotha, after preparations had been made by the ancient Hebrews. We shall speak of this again later. We are not called upon at this moment to deal with the question as to whether Christianity has already fulfilled its object or exhausted all possibilities of development. It is self-evident that in its creeds, Christianity has developed only one-sided views of the great Christ principle, and as regards some of its teachings, is positively behind other religions. But the real point is what possibilities of development it contains, what it has to give to those who penetrate more and more deeply into its nature. We have often tried to present in various ways that which can tell us of these possibilities of development. There is infinitely much to be said about it, but at present we shall only touch upon one thing that will throw light upon the point with which we are dealing. When we really have an inner understanding of different religions, we are able to call special attention to one characteristic: that in ancient times the various religions were suited to the various races, nations, and peoples of the earth. This has been preserved. We know that only he who has been born a Hindu can truly belong to the Hindu religion. In a certain respect, the older religions are tribal religions, national religions. Do not consider this description as a disparagement, but only as a characterization. The various religions which were given to the nations by initiates sprang, however, from the common fountain of an abstract world religion. But when adapted to the several nations, tribes, etc., these religions acquired something which, one might say, was in a religious sense egoistic. Nations have always loved the religion that has grown out of their own flesh and blood. We even know that when, in ancient times, through a decision of the mysteries, some particular religion was to be founded among the peoples of antiquity, a foreigner did not go to them and found a religion. He founded a second mystery, which was taken to where there was already, another already. To the nation was given a leader who belonged to his own race. In this respect, there is a great difference in regard to what may be called true Christianity. Jesus Christ, the individuality looked up to by the Christian, has had the least effect among the people and in the country where he was born. Our Western conditions with respect to religion to be regarded the same as conditions in India or China, that is, where national religions still continue? No, not at all. The conditions in Europe could only be regarded the same as in India or China, if here in Central Europe we were, for example, good followers of Wotan. We should then be in the same position. We should then have an egoistic religion here also. But in the West, egoistic religion has disappeared, for it has accepted the religion of a founder who does not belong to any particular community of people, but is outside all such. We must bear this fact in mind. That which led blood to blood and contributed toward the founding of the ancient religious communities had no share in the spread of Christianity. In the latter, the soul element was what was essential, and a religion was accepted in the West which was outside any nation. Why is this? It is because in its deepest root, Christianity was designed from the very beginning to be a faith for all men, regardless of belief, nationality, race, and all that usually separates human beings from one another. Christianity is only rightly understood when it is understood that it affects only the human in man, the human that is in all men. Although in the early ages of Christianity, and even up to the present time, various sects have appeared, that does not affect it. for Christianity contains the possibility of developing that which is human in all men. A great revolution will have to take place, even in the Christian world, if the heart of Christianity is to be rightly understood. A certain distinction will have to be drawn between the knowledge of Christianity and the reality of Christianity. Paul indeed made this distinction, and one who understands Paul may know something about it. But up to the present time, the difference has been but little understood. When Paul tore the Christian faith in Christ Jesus away from mere Judaism and said Christ died not only for the Jews, but also for the heathen, he did a great deal toward the true understanding of Christianity. For it would be quite wrong if anyone were to say that the mystery of Golgotha was accomplished only for those who call themselves Christians. It was accomplished for all men. Paul meant this when he said that Christ died for the heathen also, not merely for the Jews. For that which through the mystery of Golgotha passed into all that lives on the earth is important for all. Grotesque though it may sound to those who do not make the following distinction, we must nevertheless say, the heart of Christianity is only understood by one who observes a disciple of another religion, no matter whether he calls himself an Indian or a Chinaman or anything else, and then asks, how much of the Christian element is there in him? The essential thing is not that he should know this, but that he should know what the reality of Christianity is, just as it is not a case of our knowing physiology when we are asked whether we know the fact of digestion. One who has not as yet any conscious relation to the mystery of Golgotha from his religion has not yet understood it, but that does not give another the right to deny the reality of Christianity for him. Only when, in quotes, Christians are so far Christian that they look for what is Christian in every soul on the earth, and not when they have first implanted it in the other soul through some sort of attempt at conversion, only then will the heart of Christianity be really understood. All this is contained in properly understood Christianity. We must distinguish between the understanding and the reality of Christianity. It is a great deal to understand what has been on the earth since the mystery of Golgotha. The knowledge of this is very important to the earth, and humanity will gradually gain it, but the reality has taken place. It was actually there at the time the mystery of Golgotha was accomplished. Now our life in the sun sphere depends upon the relationship we have acquired to the mystery of Golgotha. That which can be felt in the sun sphere, the acquisition of a relation to all mankind, is only possible through a relation to the mystery of Golgotha, such as just been described, one which does not confine us to an imperfect presentation of Christianity in one creed or another. For in this case we make ourselves under all circumstances into solitary individuals in the sun sphere, who cannot find the heart and mind of others. There is a statement which holds good up to the sun sphere. When, as a being in the sun sphere, we approach another human being, this other can be a companion to us, and we shall not repel him by our presence. If we have realized in our hearts the statement, quote, when two wish to unite in my name, I can be in the midst of them, close quote. In the true knowledge of Christ, all men can come together in the sun sphere. This communion is extremely important, because in the sun sphere a crisis arises for human beings. In the sun sphere we must understand a certain thing, and we can best explain this by referring to a most important fact which should really be obvious to every mind, but about which human souls are not always clear. One of the most beautiful statements in the New Testament is contained in the passage where Christ Jesus wished to call forth the consciousness of the divine spiritual germ in man, the consciousness that, in quotes, God dwells as the divine spark in each human soul, that each human being has a divine principle within him. Christ Jesus, in calling special attention to this, said with all his might, quote, "Ye are gods, all of you," close quote. He emphasized this in such a way that we can see he considered this designation to be correct when man applies it to himself. Another being also made this statement, namely Lucifer. This is expressed symbolically in the Old Testament. At the commencement of human evolution, Lucifer made the statement, quote, "Ye shall be like the gods," close quote. Such a fact as this should be noticed. Two beings, Christ and Lucifer, make a statement, the content of which is the same in each case, quote, "Ye shall or should be like the gods," close quote. What does the Bible wish to express, as it emphasizes both very clearly? It wishes to express that from Lucifer this statement results in a curse, from Christ in the greatest blessing. Is not a wonderful mystery hidden in this? That which Lucifer threw into humanity as, quote, "the voice of the tempter," close quote, Christ could utter to mankind as the contents of the highest wisdom. In the proper document is written in clear characters that the chief thing is not the contents of some particular statement, but who makes it. Let us feel, from an instance such as this, that we must always go deeply into things, and that we can learn a very great deal from what has already been given exoterically. It is in the sun sphere between death and rebirth that we hear again and again the mighty words addressed to our human soul, "Thou art a god, thou shouldst be a god." We always know one thing most certainly when we arrive in the sun sphere. We know that Lucifer meets us there again and impresses this statement most forcibly upon our soul. From that time on, we begin to understand Lucifer very well. But we only understand Christ if upon the earth we have gradually made preparation to understand him. We bring no understanding of this statement with us into the sun sphere, in so far as it rings forth from Christ, unless we have acquired this understanding on earth through our relation to the mystery of Golgotha. It might be expressed pictorially as follows. In the sun sphere we see two thrones, one the throne of Lucifer. From this, the statement regarding our divinity rings forth in a misleading manner, and this throne is always occupied. The other throne seems to us, or perhaps it would be better to say to many human beings, still to be quite empty. For upon this other throne, in the sun sphere, we must find in our life between death and rebirth what we may call the Akashic picture of Christ. If we are able to find this Akashic picture of Christ in the sun sphere in our life between death and rebirth, it is a great blessing to us, as will be seen in the following lectures. We are only able to find it because Christ has descended from the sun and united himself with the earthly sphere, and because, through understanding the mystery of Golgotha, we are able to clear our spiritual eyes so that Christ's throne on the sun does not appear empty, but we see there the deeds he performed when he still dwelt on the sun. It is certainly the case that these sublime conditions can only be spoken of in a more or less pictorial manner, and one who gradually acquires the understanding of these things will understand that words coined on earth are futile, and that in order to make oneself understood, one has to make use of pictures. Now we are only able to understand what we need in the sun sphere when we have acquired something on earth which enters not only into the astral forces, but also into the etheric forces. If you have followed what I have tried to explain, you will know that religion enters into the etheric forces. It acts upon the human etheric body. A good spiritual heirloom remains in all of us, for forces from the sun sphere are poured into our souls when we have acquired the understanding of the mystery of Golgotha. We have to draw from the sun sphere the forces whereby we can recover our etheric body in the right way in the next incarnation. On the other hand, we draw from the other planetary spheres the forces we need in order to obtain a right astral body in the next incarnation. Now, no one ought to think that what I have just said is intended for any other purpose than to expound the path of human evolution. I even said to you before that in pre-Christian times it had been given to a leader of humanity, such as Abraham, to acquire these forces from the sun's sphere in his meeting with Melchizedek, or Melchizedek. We are not making any intolerant statement, as if a person could only acquire the power necessary to place himself in the proper relation to the being in the sun's sphere through an orthodox Christianity, but we are stating a fact in evolution. The fact is that the ancient conditions, when the Akashic picture of Christ could be seen by other means, gradually faded away as earthly evolution went on. Abraham's spiritual eyes were fully open to the Akashic picture of Christ in the sun sphere. Parenthesis, this is quite correct. The objection that the mystery of Golgotha had not yet taken place and that Christ was still on the sun does not hold good, for during that time he was connected, as to his reality, with other planetary spheres. Close parenthesis. It was really the case that at that time and up to the present, man could see what was there to be seen. And if we go back still further to those ancient times when the first teachers of the ancient Indians, the holy rishis, were the leaders of their people, there also were leaders to whom Christ was well known. At that time he was still in the sun, and the holy rishis taught their disciples to understand him, although they did not use his later name. Although the mystery of Golgotha had not yet worked in the sphere of knowledge of those ancient times, it was quite possible for those who drew the secret truths from the depths of being to obtain that which made it possible for them to draw from the sun the force wherewith to renew their etheric body in the proper manner. These possibilities ceased as mankind developed further, and they had to cease because new powers had necessarily to be added to humanity. What we have said is intended to be taken as a fact of evolution. We are living toward a future when people will deprive themselves more and more of the power to live through the sun sphere properly in the period between death and rebirth, if they withdraw themselves from the Christ event. It is true we have to look for what is Christian in each soul. If we wish to understand the heart of Christianity, we have to inquire in every single case, quote, how much in him is Christian, close quote. But it is also true that a person can cut himself off from Christianity by not realizing what it really is. If we repeat Paul's statement, quote, Christ died not only for the Jews, but also for the heathen, close quote, we may add, but if, in the further progress of humanity, people were to cut themselves off from Christianity and reject the mystery of Golgotha consciously, they would hinder what had then been done from reaching them. The beneficent deed of the mystery of Golgotha took place for all mankind. It is open to every human being to let this blessing act upon him. But in the future, very much will depend upon how he lets it act upon him, and whether he will seek out of the sun sphere the forces which are necessary in order that in his next incarnation he may produce his etheric body in the right way. In the near future, I will speak of the immeasurable consequence of this for the entire future of the human race on earth. The Christianity that followed the mystery of Golgotha was the earliest preparation whereby mankind was enabled to come into true relationship with the sun sphere, though little of this was understood at first. A true anthroposophical understanding of the mystery of Golgotha will follow as a second impulse. The right relationship to the sun sphere is gained when we learn to penetrate more and more deeply into this mystery. After man has lived into the sun sphere, he expands further and enters the Mars sphere. This is not merely a matter of gaining the right relationship to the sun forces in the sun sphere, but of carrying this with him when he enters the Mars sphere. In order that consciousness shall not grow dim or cease after the sun sphere, but that it may be carried over into the spheres of Mars and Jupiter, it is necessary in our cycle of human evolution that the anthroposophical understanding of the various religions and conceptions of the world shall enter into human souls. This is why we endeavor to understand the various religions and points of view of the world. In place of anthroposophical understanding, another very different understanding will come, of which humanity has at present no conception. For though a truth may be true in one age, when it is filled with the sense of truth, it is also true that fresh impulses will continually enter human evolution. It is quite true that what anthroposophy or spiritual science has to give is of value only for a certain age, so that when humanity assimilates anthroposophy, it may carry this into the future as an inwardly digested impulse, in order to acquire subsequent powers by the forces it has already assimilated. We have shown the connection between life on earth and the life between death and rebirth. No one can fail to see that it is just as necessary for us to have a knowledge and a feeling for the life between death and rebirth as for earthly life itself. Because when we enter upon earthly life, our welfare, our confidence, our strength and hope during this earthly life depend upon what forces we bring with us from the life we have passed through between our last death and our present birth. What forces we are able to bring from there, however, depend upon the manner in which we conducted ourselves in our former incarnation, as also the moral views, religious life, or general frame of mind we then acquired. Thus, we ought to remember that in the supersensible world, in which we live between death and rebirth, we have an active share in furthering either the upward evolution of the entire human race or its destruction. If people do not acquire the forces capable of giving them healthy astral bodies, the human astral body will become barren and empty, and humanity on the earth will degenerate morally and also in its religion. And if they do not acquire the forces necessary for healthy etheric bodies, the human race will pine away on the earth. Each one may form for himself the conception, how hard I ought to work if sickly bodies only are not to develop upon the earth. Anthroposophy is not merely a teaching. It is a responsibility which brings us into touch and keeps us in touch with all the beings connected with the earth. The end of Lecture 2.